In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Bumble. So, you want to find someone you're compatible with, specifically someone who's ready for a serious connection, totally open to having kids in the future, is a tall, rock-climbing Libra, and loves rom-coms with vegan pizzas on Tuesdays just as much as you do. Bumble knows that you know exactly what's right for you. So, whatever it is you're looking for, Bumble's features can help you find it. Date now on Bumble.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. This month sees the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, and today on the podcast, we've got a conversation about children who survived the Nazi concentration camps with Dr. Rebecca Clifford, Associate Professor of History at Swansea University. Rebecca is the author of an upcoming book, Survivors, Children After the Holocaust, and she spoke to BBC History Revealed editor Charlotte Hodgman about 300 Jewish children who were brought to the Lake District to build new lives after surviving the Holocaust.
So we were talking previously about this is a big year for anniversaries, Second World War anniversaries, particularly regarding around the Holocaust.
Yes.
So we're approaching the 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. But we're going to want to be talking about another perhaps less known part of this of Holocaust history, which are the kind of the orphans of the Holocaust, the children who survived the death camps, survived the Holocaust, and some of whom came to Britain, to the Lake District. Yeah. So tell us a little bit about how this actually happened. Who were these children, and how were they brought to Britain in August 1945?
Absolutely. Well, maybe I can start off by saying a bit about children who survived the Holocaust in a broader sense.
Yes.
Because there were an estimated between 150,000 and 180,000 children who survived the Holocaust. That is only 10% of Europe's pre-war Jewish population of children. So really, a child's chances of surviving the Holocaust were very, very low. Of the children who survived, there were many ways that children could survive the Holocaust. For younger children, most were not liberated from concentration camps. Most survived in hiding throughout Europe, being hidden by non-Jewish families, often families in the countryside. That was happening, you know, from France to Poland, everywhere there were hidden children. But there were children in all the major concentration camps as well. Of course, when we talk about children, I think we probably think first and foremost of young children. But yeah, the definition of what was a child is important here because different organizations defined childhood differently. Many of these children were, in fact, teenagers. Mm. Right? So teenagers up to 16, up to 18. Mm-hmm. So for the children who came to Britain in the summer of 1945, the vast majority of them were teenagers, mostly boys, mostly 16 years old or older.
Mm. Okay.
So I work specifically on the very young children, but they were a tiny, tiny handful. Mm. They had a different trajectory, as it were. So the children who came in August 1945 all came from the ghetto camp of Theresienstadt. But not all of them had actually spent all that much time in Theresienstadt. So towards the end, like Theresienstadt's basically liberated right at the moment the war ends. In fact, actually, the Russian army took control of the camp the day after the war ended in Europe. So the 9th of May, 1945. The older children who were, you know, part of this cohort that came to Britain, most of them had only spent, you know, maybe just a couple of weeks in Theresienstadt because they had come from other camps on death marches. Mm. As the Nazi Empire collapsed, there weren't too many places left where prisoners could be taken. So some of them had come from Auschwitz. Some of them had come from Buchenwald. Buchenwald, of course, was liberated in April 1945. Some of them had actually come from both, from Auschwitz, moved to Buchenwald, then moved to Theresienstadt. So there was this huge influx of prisoners. But it wasn't the same for the younger children. The younger children had often spent years in Theresienstadt. In fact, for I think all the children who I look at, all of whom were 10 years old or younger at the time of liberation, they had no memories of any life before the camp. Their earliest memories are always from the camp.
And Theresienstadt wasn't, just to clarify, wasn't a death camp, was it?
That's
right. What type of camp was it?
It is a very hard camp to classify because there was no other camp like it. It's sometimes called a ghetto camp. It's sometimes called a transit camp. You could call it a concentration camp. It's all of them. Mm. It was a place that was envisioned as a sort of model camp, which was really meant for show.
Okay.
By then, the Nazis meant it as a sort of camp for show to prove to the Red Cross and other concerned international bodies that prisoners were being treated properly, which is, of course, completely untrue.
Mm.
What made Theresienstadt special, however, was that there were, well, among other things, there were a number of children's homes in the camp. There was nothing like this in any other camp. And children in the camp were protected to a degree. Now, the children, the very young children who came to Britain in the summer of 1945, they had all been in a ward for motherless children in Theresienstadt. And actually, they all knew each other from the camp.
Mm.
In the autumn, late autumn of 1944, the children's homes in Theresienstadt were all liquidated. And most of the children were sent to Auschwitz, where almost all of them were murdered upon arrival. So why these very young children were still in Theresienstadt when it was liberated, that's a question that can't be answered.
Mm, okay. So most of them, or some of them, would have actually experienced places like Auschwitz and, like you say, Buchenwald, where conditions would have been a lot different, would they?
Absolutely. Mm. I mean, this is, we're talking about the older children here, so yeah, with mostly teenage boys would have been working in places like Buchenwald, in Auschwitz-Birkenau, as slave laborers. Some of them had years of experience of slave labor. Then they had come on death marches. They were often almost, you know, barely alive by the time they got to Theresienstadt. They were literally hanging on even a few more weeks, and they probably couldn't have survived. Yeah. By the time they arrived in Theresienstadt, the camp itself had changed because all these tens of, I can't remember exactly the number, but a considerable number of prisoners on death marches had come to the camp, and suddenly the conditions were, you know, horrific.
Mm.
They brought typhus with them and dysentery, so that people were dying like flies, as one of the the boy says, who I talk about in the article.
Yeah.
So in a sense, by the time they arrived at the model camp, it was no longer very different from any of the other concentration camps.
So once these had been liberated, we're sort of talking about really a handful of children who kind of came over to England. What happened generally to children who, you know, found themselves without parents or family, you know, at the end of the Holocaust?
Great question. Just to put that kind of number of children in perspective, and we will never know exactly how many children that was, you know, the children who at the time, in the parlance of the time, were called unaccompanied children. But some sort of, you know, tens of thousands of, yeah. of Jewish children. They were, of course, existing in a sea of 13 million children across Europe who had lost at least one parent in the war. So the experience of being a confused and unaccompanied child at the end of the war was not just a Jewish experience. It was a very common European experience for children. There was a kind of, I think you could go so far as to say there was a sort of battle over who got to claim those children, in fact, with a lot of different groups competing to claim the children. There were reports at the time in Britain, certainly the aid agencies who were looking for children on the ground in Europe, trying to help the children they found in camps, were sending back reports to, you know, the agencies based in London saying, there's no young children left alive. But it wasn't true. There were young children left alive, not in enormous numbers in the camps, but the difficult question of who should get to claim these children made it very, you know, it wasn't straightforward where they could go. There were Zionist groups who wanted to claim the children for Palestine. There were local Jewish organizations who wanted to claim the children. Of course, their Jewish communities had been decimated. They were thinking about how can we regrow. There were international humanitarian aid organizations like the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Administration. They were trying to decide, you know, if these children have surviving relatives, should they be returned to their relatives? I mean, the fairly difficult questions involved. For the children that came to Britain, there was a lot of work done to try to make sure that they had no surviving parents or relatives. Of course, in the end, some of them did.
Yeah.
And these relatives were eventually found. Not all of them went back to live with their families, however, and that was quite a common experience if you look outside this small group of children.
So there were about 300, weren't there, children, yes. sort of aged toddler up to sort of 16?
Actually aged up to, okay, so the British Jewish community negotiated with the Home Office to bring these children and got the Home Office to agree to allow 1,000 camp survivor children into Britain. The Home Office's own stipulation was that the children had to be younger than 16.
Right.
But knowing what the reality on the ground was going to be like, some of the representatives of the Central British Fund, which was the main agency that took responsibility for the children, a Jewish British agency, they said, well, you're going to have to allow for the fact that we might not know the age of many of these children. So even though the Home Office had said only under 16, 75% of the children were actually older than 16.
Okay. Yep.
In fact, there were some that we, well, at least one that was even older than 18. I mean, you have to keep in mind these children were really good for obvious reasons at lying about their age.
Mm.
It had obviously kind of helped them survive in cases. So they saw an opportunity. They were happy to pretend they were only 15 years old.
Yeah.
In the end, then they found that most of them were older. Very young children, there were not many.
Yeah. One question I was wondering was why you mentioned in the piece that the British government wasn't keen on having any children come here, which kind of surprised me because you mentioned that, you know, there were sort of these images coming out from these concentration camps and Europe was finding out, or the world was finding out for the first time what had actually been going on. Why were the British government so reluctant to help these children?
There are a lot of reasons, and just in the I don't want to defend the British government, but no one wanted to take these children. It wasn't just Britain, I suppose. I wanted to say that. There was no country that was enthusiastic about taking the children, although there were many Jewish organizations that wanted to take the children. At the kind of level of national governments, there was no enthusiasm anywhere. In terms of why this was the case in Britain, obviously there was anti-Semitism. I'm not going to pretend that wasn't the case. There was a group of conservative MPs. This was actually during the war and not after, who wrote an official letter saying our Jewish community is big enough. We really don't want any more. Which, if you know anything about the British Jewish community, you'll know it's not very big.
Yeah.
Even there was a fair amount of reluctance among British Jews as well, because they didn't particularly want to draw attention to themselves. There's obviously a long history of anti-Semitism in this country. Mm. There were fears that refugees from the continent with very different ways, with, you know, not able to speak English and different customs, would bring unwanted attention to the Jewish community as a whole. There were also concerns about, you know, labor issues. And so actually one of the stipulations was that the children would not work. Mm. But keeping in mind that Britain was unique in many ways, because we had 10,000 children come on the kinder transport. There were kinder transport children that went to other countries as well, but Britain took more than any other country. So they were still at this point, you know, kind of during the war and afterwards, concerns about what would happen to those children as well. So there was possibly a kind of thinking that, well, we already have a lot of children. We don't know if we're going to be able to ever return them. We don't want any more.
Yeah.
So the Home Office stipulated that the children who came, well, they came on visas that only allowed them to stay 2 years. Mm-hmm. The goal was not for them to settle in Britain. That was never the goal. The goal was for them to come to Britain, have a period of recuperation, and move on.
Mm.
Of course, that's not what happened, but the Home Office was quite worried, and the aid agencies, they had to deal with that fear as best they could, which is why they effectively took over, you know, they took charge of the children, and all the funds for helping these children came from the British Jewish community. The government didn't add a penny.
Right, okay. And there were sort of two main women, weren't there, behind kind of getting the children here, and also the Central British Fund. So Alice Goldberger and Anna Freud. Tell us a little bit about those women. They sound quite remarkable.
There were so many remarkable women involved, actually. It's not just those two, but we'd be here all day if I was going to tell you about all of them, because this was humanitarian aid was in many ways a kind of new field. It obviously had existed before the First World War, but this was really a burgeoning field in which there were lots of opportunities for women to step into professional roles. Mm. So you find aid agencies like the Central British Fund. There's a lot of women that hold very important roles in these agencies. But in terms of the two who you've just mentioned, Alice Goldberger is an absolutely fascinating person about which I always feel like I wish I knew more.
Mm.
She never left any collection of her own personal papers that allow me to better see who she was as a person. But she trained in early childhood education and early childcare. She was from Berlin. Born at the end of the previous century, she had a lot of experience working with young children. And she, like many German Jews, left, I don't want to tell you the wrong date, but, you know, there's sort of an outflux of German Jews in 1938-39 before the war started. I think she arrived in Britain in 1939. Like many so-called enemy aliens, she was then interned by the British government. She was interned on the Isle of Man. But because she had this experience working with children and was interested in psychoanalysis, she was actually kind of, you know, helped out of internment on the Isle of Man by Anna Freud. Anna Freud was, of course, the daughter of Sigmund Freud, but in her own right was one of the founders of the field of child psychoanalysis. And she had a a very important project during the Second World War. She founded and ran something called the Hampstead War Nurseries. The war nurseries were places where children who'd basically lost their homes for whatever reason, young children, could go to live. There were three different sites for the Hampstead War Nurseries. And so children whose houses had been bombed or whose mothers were working in the war industries and couldn't care for them could go to live in Anna Freud's Hampstead War Nurseries. And Alice Goldberger, once she was taken out of internment, headed up one of the Hampstead War Nursery at New Barn. So she had a lot of experience working with children in kind of traumatic situation, really. So in the summer of 1945, she was recruited to help run a reception center at Windermere for these children who came from Theresienstadt. So that she effectively left the Hampstead War Nurseries and went immediately to Windermere, where she was one of the people who organized care for these children.
Yeah, and there's some lovely sort of details about them getting all the dormitories ready and, yes. and all for the children when they came. Because, of course, they didn't know who they were going to be receiving, did they?
Yes. I to this day find it remarkable that the communication was that poor, that they had no idea who was coming. They simply knew that 300 children were going to arrive, at night. And they were, as I think we all would, when you hear children, you think of young children.
Yeah.
So they were ready for young children. So they went all around and they put all these teddy bears and dolls on the beds. And of course, then the children who arrived were teenage boys.
Yeah.
Mostly.
But there were a handful of sort of little ones,
yes.
weren't there? So, I mean, what sort of in terms of health and mental health, how were the children when they arrived? I mean, you can't even imagine sort of the trauma that they've been through. How do they go about sort of helping them really to sort of build a new life for themselves?
They were, I have to say, the care workers who were involved in the Windermere reception camp, they were a remarkable bunch of individuals. They were often very interested in and informed by psychoanalysis. Quite, it was a growing field at the time. It was kind of a new thing. And they had thought very carefully about, what they knew about the situation that the children had come out of. And they knew, for example, that the children in concentration camps had had years where their lives had been, dictated by rules, hideous rules, too. Mm. So they thought, right, rules probably aren't the right way to go forwards for the children once they arrive. We need to give them quite a lot of freedom so we can earn their trust, basically. Mm. And we know that's not going to be easy. There's some wonderful accounts of the older children, actually. One of the care workers who worked with them at Windermere, a woman named Margot Hicklin, she saw the boys, the older boys, one day just in a fit taking all these chairs and breaking them. And she didn't know, should I stop them breaking the chairs or should I just let them break the chairs? And she thought, well, they've got some aggression they need to get out. Let's just let them break the chairs. But she did ask, why are you breaking the chairs? And one of them said, it's because we didn't have a chance to break the heads of the Nazis in the camp. So we need to get it out now.
Mm.
So she said, well, fine, get it out and you'll feel better for it. Which was actually quite a sort of radical approach to childcare, both at the time and now, for that matter. For the younger children, I mean, the very fact that Anna Freud was involved should be kind of a big, signal that psychologists and psychoanalysts were really interested. They were expecting the children to not be normal, as it were. In fact, the word they often used for the children was denormalized. There's a kind of assumption there. And actually, I think the children were probably much more normal than they gave them credit for. But they kept a very, very close eye on these children, very carefully took notes on their behavior. And then one of the things they found about the children was actually that they really had a very deep distrust of adults, which wasn't surprising because they hadn't had too many adults stick around in their lives up until that point. But they had great faith in each other. They knew each other well. And so they behaved in a group. The kind of role that normally would exist between a mother and a child, for example, a child and his or her parents, that was fulfilled by the group in the case of the younger children. And actually, in the end, you know, psychoanalysts like Anna Freud believed very deeply that normal development in a child came from a healthy relationship with a mother. These children deeply challenged that because they had not had any relationships with their mother. So the assumption on the part of kind of, you know, standard psychoanalytic theory was, well, they must necessarily then have you know, psychological problems. In the end, actually, they didn't. And so Anna Freud really had to revise her own thoughts and say, well, the group has stepped in here and has played the role of the mother and the father. And the children, yes, they had some strange behaviors, but they overcame them quite quickly.
Yeah. Was that the same with the older children?
I think probably yes. I mean, there was a really terrible and very damaging assumption that the children would not be normal. Mm. And if we step away from these, the small group of children, and look at that much bigger group of unaccompanied children, that fear was there universally. The aid agencies and lots of writers and different people who were kind of observing the children in the early post-war period were terrified that they would be almost as if there was a kind of like infection in them and that they would never get better. And actually, they, you know, for the most part, came out to be completely normal and ordinary people.
Yeah.
I think one of the hardest things for them was overcoming that assumption that they would be abnormal.
Yes, yes.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
This, you know, for us, it makes us feel sad, but it's important to remember that for the children, it made them angry.
Yeah.
The parents had betrayed them. They didn't come back. And they needed to talk that through with a sympathetic person who could explain, you know, your mom wanted to come back, but she couldn't come back.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
The Hargan women seemed to have it all.
We were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But detectives would soon discover
inside the house there were the bodies of two women.
A story of betrayal you would struggle to believe if it wasn't true.
I am just praying to God, this is a sick joke.
From 48 Hours, this is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings, starting May 8th wherever you get your podcasts.
And what about health-wise? You mentioned that in the piece that one of the stipulations made by the government was that they all had to be sort of healthy children. But actually some of them did actually have TB.
Yes.
Were there any other sort of health problems that kind of had as a result of, you know, the malnourishment and the conditions that they lived in?
So absolutely. And I think I mentioned before, you know, the children were good at hiding their age for good reasons. They were also very good at hiding illness for, you know, the same reasons, basically. Many of the children were ill, although none of them were very ill or very visibly ill. And I've always wondered to myself, I mean, as you've said, the Home Office stipulated they had to be well. And, you know, Britain had this scheme to bring over 1,000 concentration camp survivor children. But lots of several other countries had a similar scheme, and they all stipulated the same thing. We will not take any child who is not physically well and mentally well as well.
Mm.
Of course, then unwell children did slip through the net. For the younger children, a lot of them were suffering from vitamin deficiency.
Yeah.
Of the very youngest children of all, two of the girls had severe problems with the strabismus of the eyes from vitamin deficiency, and one of the boys couldn't walk very well because he'd been so deprived of vitamins. But they overcame these problems as they got nourishment, basically.
Yeah.
It took time. It took time to overcome them. I mean, young bodies were bound more quickly, but it could take years. And for the older children who had TB, I can't remember which one of the children it was, but I remember reading this account once and very much stayed with me. It was just about how boring it was to recover from TB. I mean, keeping in mind, we did have antibiotics. They had only recently come into use at the time. But still, treatment for TB was just a long, arduous period of rest.
Yeah.
And some of them kind of were forced to rest for 3 years. And after being in the camps and putting their lives on hold, and they were like, you know, teenagers, they just wanted to get out and live.
Yeah.
And it was just so horrible to have to wait and postpone life and wait and wait and wait. But they did eventually all get better.
Mm, yeah. I mean, as part of your research, you've tracked down a lot of the some of these children who actually came to Britain, and you've spoken to them, and you've, you know, you've heard their sort of memories of that. That must have been quite a moving and quite an extraordinary experience to find these well, men and women now. How did you, you know, tell me a little bit about that. How did you find them in the first place?
I think by accident, rather, because I have for the past many years now been working on a book, not on these specific children, but very broadly on child survivors of the Holocaust. And specifically, I have been interested in their post-war lives. So how they kind of walked out of the remains of Europe and got on with their lives. And so when I was starting research for that book, I'm an oral historian by training. So I, you know, the main way I do research is by interviewing people. And that's what I love. That's my favorite part of my job. And so when I was starting this project, I put out a call. There's an association called the Child Survivors Association of Great Britain. And in their newsletter, I just put a little blurb saying, I'm writing a book on child survivors of the Holocaust. You know, if you'd be willing to have an interview with me, I'd love to hear from you.
Mm.
And the first two people to contact me were actually two of the toddlers who arrived.
Wow.
So I had not known anything about their stories before that time. So I really learned from them. And I just thought to myself, this is such an extraordinary story. It actually deserves its own book. So that's the book I'm starting now. So now that this sort of broad book on child survivors generally is finished, I'll be starting a book on this very specific group of child survivors, because I think here's a story that just... it's just screaming to be told.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned three individuals in the piece. We've been talking sort of before this interview about how some of them were quite willing to share their experiences, but others were a bit more kind of reticent and perhaps hadn't faced, you know, the things that had happened to them. Tell me some of the things that you found out from some of the stories that you found out from these people that you interviewed.
So when I, as I said, the two first people to contact me doing this other project, well, two of them were among the toddlers who arrived in August 1945 to Britain. And one of those toddlers was Jackie Young, whose story is described in the article. I mean, Jackie's story is really amazing. And so I interviewed him, I think, back in 2014, and I thought, this is an incredible story, because here's a boy who was so young when he was deported, really just, you know, an infant.
He was a baby, 9 months old, wasn't he?
Right?
Yeah.
And he has obviously then no memory of his mother, no memory of any family. His mother was unmarried, and so he was born out of wedlock. He's tried his whole life to learn more about this brave woman who was his mother, who tried to protect him, and there's very limited information about her. But in any case, so he was an infant sent off by himself to Theresienstadt, and he managed to survive. And he came to Britain in August 1945. And he was among this group of toddlers who was so closely observed by people working for Anna Freud. And then he was very quickly adopted. And I think to understand Jackie's story, you need to understand adoption in the 1940s and 50s, because it was not generally the case back then that adoptee parents told children that they were adopted or explained their histories. Mm. Or that came later. That's something that kind of develops from the 1960s, 1970s. But yeah. So Jackie's parents were not unusual in that they hid his history from him. But still, he found out through a series of really very shocking events when he was kind of in his, I think from sort of age 10 through age 20. First, he found out that he was adopted and he sort of had to deal with that. And then somebody let slip that actually he wasn't just adopted, but he wasn't even British. And he'd always just thought of himself as a, you know, Jewish London guy. And this was a real shock to find out he was Austrian. But the real shocker came when he was getting married. I think he was 20 years old. And of course, to get married in the Jewish tradition, you have to prove that you are Jewish. And the easiest way to do that is to show that your mother was Jewish. Mm. So, but of course, Jackie was adopted. So when he went to register the marriage, the officials said, well, we have to know that your birth mother was Jewish. And his adopted mother said, oh, you'll just have to, you know, take my word for it. She was. And they're like, well, that's not good enough. So his adoptive mother said, okay, I've got some papers that will prove it. They're in the safety deposit box. I'll go and get them. So she did. And they're all there. You know, there's Jackie and his fiance and his fiance's mother. And his adoptive mother comes back with these papers. And as she's handing them over to the officials, he just grabs them and looks at them and sees that he was from a concentration camp. Oh. He was, you know, a young man. He had no idea. And he just started screaming, why didn't you tell me? So this is, you know, a really extraordinary aspect of Jackie's story. It's not just kind of where he's come from, but how he learned about who he is. And I think he's certainly, you know, not alone in having spent many decades of his life then trying to put the pieces together to see, who am I? You know, where did I come from?
Did he manage to find out about his mother in the end?
He has found out a great, great deal. And he has done an extraordinary amount of research. Mm-hmm. But as is always the case when you deal with the Holocaust, it's often easier to find out about people's deaths than about their lives. Yeah. And that's very unsatisfying in a lot of ways. I have the experience actually from my own family. So my mother is also a child Holocaust survivor. And I was doing research trying to find out about her father, my grandfather. Mm. And I found a great deal out about his death, but it's his life I want to know about. And that remains terribly, you know, that's intangible, really. So I think I know from talking to Jackie that the one thing he wishes so badly he had was a picture of his mother. But all the searching has never turned up a picture. And probably at this point, he's done everything he can. And he's had archivists working with him. And probably that is not going to be possible. But he's certainly done a quite remarkable amount. I mean, in a way, for those who wanted to know about their past, they kind of had to become historians. Mm. They had to learn how archives work and how to crack them open. And sometimes they were working, you know, before the end of the Cold War, when it was very difficult to, not impossible, to get archival records that were on the other side of the wall.
Yeah. And you mentioned earlier that some children did actually find out that they did have surviving parents, and again, is we mentioned one of those boys in the piece. Yes. What happened there?
So, in a broad sense, I can tell you about that specific case as well. But in a broad sense, I don't think we'll ever be able to establish just how many child survivors of the Holocaust had surviving parents. But it's probably a higher number than you would think. Mm. If you look at individual countries or individual regions, we can see that it's often about like a quarter to a third had at least one surviving parent. So it was not an uncommon experience to discover, oh my gosh, my mother's alive, my father's alive. It was also not an uncommon experience to not really be able to make that relationship work again. Keeping in mind, of course, that survivor parents had gone, you know, they were often camp survivors as well, having gone through something psychologically very, very difficult to deal with. They also had nothing at the end of the war. The systems for returning property to Jews who had their property stolen from them, well, it was non-existent in places. So they couldn't necessarily reclaim their homes. And there was an enormous shortage of housing after the war. So they had nowhere to live. They didn't have jobs. They had no way to care for their surviving children. It was quite common to feel that a child, especially a young child, would be better off in the care of an aid agency, you know, better than with an impoverished family barely scraping by. And indeed, when I think about the children who were returned to their parents in my broader study, well, none of them had a very good experience. This was a really very, very difficult experience. So the specific case I talk about in the article is Vicky Kohnheim. He was one of the children, obviously, who came to Britain in August 1945. And he... Alice Goldberger discovered in 1946 that his mother was alive. It might even have been late 45. I can't remember.
Also quite
early on. Yeah. I think it was 1946. The Red Cross relayed a message that she was looking for her son. She was working in Austria at the time. I mean, she had survived quite a, you know, crazy journey on her own. And there was a lot of communication for a long time about, do we return Vicky to her or do we not return Vicky to her? She seemed to have, by that point, also have had some other children by another father. There was a lot of debate about it. And in the end, she didn't take him back.
So it wasn't up to her. She couldn't make that decision.
There were lots of people involved in the decision. Like, and there was a lot of wariness. I mean, like Alice Goldberger was very worried. I don't have any doubt that she loved Vicky and she wanted to protect him, and she wasn't sure that returning him to his mother was really the best thing to do.
Yeah. And
so you can see in the archival records, there's a long debate of what do we do? Do we send him back? Do we not send him back? Does she really? And then she was sort of moving around. She immigrated to the United States at a point. And finally, when Vicky was in his late teens, he decided for himself, well, I want to go and try to make this work.
Mm.
So he emigrated to the States to live with his mother, who was at that time living in a very, very small community, about I think like 3 or 4 hours away from Seattle. And he had a go of it. And like so, so many other child survivors, it did not work out. She was struggling emotionally and psychologically in her own way, and they just couldn't connect. And of course, he'd grown up and he'd never known her.
Yeah.
So he ended up staying and living in Seattle. He still lives in the Seattle area to this day. But he left his mother's home fairly quickly. And you know, by that point, he was a young man ready to make his own life. He went into the military and he, did his own training. But that was a relationship that did not work out. And that was not an uncommon story.
Did they talk much about what kind of the experiences, or were those sorts of memories blocked out?
So this is a really, really interesting question, basically, because for many years, I mean, these were children who lived in a kind of ambit with psychologists, right? Because they, you know, these were in some ways Anna Freud's, the children that she had worked to make this home for. And there were a lot of assumptions about the nature of the children's memory. So most of the children were interviewed by a psychologist named Sarah Moskowitz, an American psychologist, in the late 1970s and early 1980s. And there was some discussion in those interviews about, you know, do you think you've blocked out the memories? And I don't think any of the children particularly blocked out the memories. I think they were too young to remember, right? Because we don't remember our first 3 years of life. That's a well-established kind of – we don't really understand why that happens, but we do know that that's the case. So these children were – I mean, they were kind of around the age of 3, 4, 5 when they were liberated. So it shouldn't surprise us that they have fragmented memories.
Yeah.
That's the nature of how all of us remember our childhoods. And the only way that we're able to make a coherent story out of our childhoods is because someone helps us understand how those memories fit together. And that someone is usually our mother or our father. Right? If you don't have a mother or father, there's no one to help you put it together. So like there's another child I discuss in the article, Zenka Husserl. She does have memories of the camp. You know, but they're fragmented.
Yeah.
But they make sense, you know, to a historian. I thought, oh, right, I get it right away. She remembers having her head shaved when she arrived because of lice. And she remembers screaming. And she remembers the guards who who the guards, the dogs that the SS guards had.
Yeah.
One of the other children who I don't talk about in the article has this memory of being kind of made one day to undress and then walk around naked in the sunshine, you know, not as something traumatic or anything, just as this kind of strange memory of why did they make us walk around naked in the sunshine? Of course, well, we know why that is. The Red Cross was coming to inspect the camp, and they wanted the children to sort of look a bit healthier. So they tried to get some sun on their skin, basically. So some of the kids have memories of these specific incidences. Often their memories are more of things like, oh, there was like, you know, like a flower box on the window ledge and we got in trouble for digging in the dirt, or these things children remember. Somebody locked us in the closet. And so they all have fragmentary memories of the camp.
Yeah, yeah. And I suppose they wouldn't have seen their parents if they did travel with their parents to a camp initially. They would
Some
have been split
of them,
up.
Yes. And in fact, it was probably the fact that they were split up that helped them to survive.
Yeah.
Because children who were with, there were children who were with their parents in Tarasian Steppe, but they tended to have a more precarious, you know, circumstances, basically.
Yeah.
The children's homes were in some ways protected in the camp. So those children had some protections on them up until the autumn of 1944. But a few of the children do remember seeing their parents in the camp. In fact, one of the children, if you could see the photograph I'm pointing at now, it was her. she remembers her mother coming into the room and giving her a piece of bread and saying, "I'll come back." But the mother never came back. And after the war, that little girl, Tanya, she kind of told this story to Alice Goldberger and said, "I can't forgive my mother." So, you know, for us, it makes us feel sad, but it's important to remember that for the children, it made them angry.
Yeah.
The parents had betrayed them. They didn't come back. And they needed to talk that through with a sympathetic person who could explain, you know, your mom wanted to come back, but she couldn't come back.
That was Rebecca Clifford. Her book, Survivors, Children After the Holocaust, is due to be published in August 2020 by Yale University Press. Rebecca has also written a feature on this topic for the January issue of BBC History Revealed. You can read that on our website at historyextra.com/Holocaust Orphans. This story is also the subject of a new BBC Two drama, The Windermere Children, which airs at 9 p.m. next Monday, 27th of January. That's all for today. Thanks for listening. Today's podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt and Jack Bateman. We'll be back on Monday when Claire Wright will be discussing the battle for women's suffrage in Australia.